Today, on the exam room.
I don't know if I was choosing life. I think I was choosing delayed death. I had many rock bottoms, but probably the final bottom was sitting by my dad's grave site as he was getting lowered into the grave. And I had been trying to get cleaned up. And then, you know, when my dad died, you know, I went full on. Like I went on a huge binge. And I was a mess at the funeral. That's how the book opens up, at the side of his grave. So I would say that was the rock bottom. After, you know, we buried my dad, Heather's mom, you know, had leukemia that turned into lymphoma and ultimately a brain tumor, would end her life early. So we buried her. And there was a moment where, you know, Heather was getting me dressed and where she was putting my socks and shoes on. And I thought, oh, crap. Like two funerals pretty much in a row, she's got to do another one. And I didn't want her to do another funeral this soon. And my idea was, let's get some space in between these. Just give her a break. Let things get back to normal. Let the kids get back into practice and start the sports again. Kind of get back into a routine. I mean, we've been running to cancer wards and blood transfusions and, you know, picking out caskets and putting obituaries in the paper, things that I never knew we would ever have to do. And I just, all I could think of is like, I gotta space my death out so she gets a break between funerals. She can do this next year. So the reality was, when I started going on this road to try to get better, it wasn't really to get better, it was just to not die as soon.
Welcome to the Exam Room Podcast, brought to you by the Physicians Committee. Hi, I'm the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll, raising health IQs coast to coast and around the world. Hi to the Exam Roomies listening in Fresno, California, Columbia, Missouri, and Quebec City, Canada. Wherever you are, we appreciate you helping to make the world a healthier place. This is episode 36 of season 7, number 535 overall. Tim Kaufman, he is a man who has transformed his life and well-being, and by doing so rose to internet notoriety as the founder of Fat Man Rants. He is here today with us and has a new book out detailing his journey to recovery. The book is called Escape, Breaking Free from a Self-Made Prison. And for years he found himself in that cell, confined away from the life that he wanted. And he was battling a triple addiction of food, drugs, and alcohol. But any one of those highs, any one of them was just a temporary release, one that ultimately would extend his sentence, a sentence that very well could have been the death penalty. But Tim had a prison break, a breakthrough to a healthier life, and that is what we will be talking about with him today. How he was able to escape that personal hell that he created, and now how he maintains his freedom. Freedom from food, from drugs, and from alcohol. And a big key to that for Tim, as you will hear us talk about, is avoiding the trap of the cheat day, something that most of us celebrate. But Tim is of the mindset that cheat days don't really work for other areas of our life. So why in the world would it be any different for food? This is unique insight from a man who has been beaten raw by life. And also, we're going to talk about how three words that he wrote in a journal changed his entire outlook for the future. Three words that finally forced him to admit that he was not a failure. Three words. I did good. Wisdom is coming from the author of Escape, Tim Kaufman, and our powerful conversation begins now on the Exam Room. Tim, thanks for being here and congrats on the release of the new book, my man.
Thank you so much, Chuck. And Chuck, thank you for having me. And thank you for everything you do to spread the message of health and hope. I certainly appreciate it. And I know I'm not alone.
Man, the pleasure is definitely all mine, and I'm really just so happy for you to be able to get this book out here. I think that, you know, people need to understand that, like, number one, this is a really powerful read, and number two, the cover is one of the more powerful book covers I've ever seen in my entire life because it so captures your entire story.
Yeah, I think it captures actually a lot of people's stories. The whole idea of the self-made prison, you know, a lot of times we go through life and we think that these circumstances are what's holding us back, when the truth is the whole time, you know, we ourselves are building this prison by trading our future for choices that we think make us happy in the present. And before we know it, you know, I know I felt like I was in this prison that I couldn't get out of. And the truth is the whole time, I was holding the keys right in my hand. So it's kind of a weird place to be. I think the prison gets built so slowly over time that you don't even realize you're building it until you're so far in that it seems hopeless and you can't get out. So I'm sure that's not a feeling that I feel, you know, exclusively. I'm sure a lot of people feel like that.
No, and I think people need to understand that when it comes to these self-made prisons, we're not just talking about substances of abuse here in terms of drugs. I mean, I think that self-made prison really gets built around us from a very young age in terms of our food as well. As somebody who has battled both food and drug addiction, which of the two was the tougher habit to kick?
I think they're both very similar, but they're also both very different. And so, you know, when I do presentations and when I speak and do podcasts, and I know I've shared my story on here before, I say these things that I used to escape reality with. And I start with, you know, opioid tablets, and then I was addicted to fentanyl, then alcohol. And all throughout that, I was addicted to food, and the more hyper palatable, the more salty and oily and sugary the food was, the better it made me feel. And I talk about the similarities between, you know, waiting in line to get the food literally was like waiting at, you know, the pharmacy to get a script filled. And that same feeling, you know, that same kind of excitement, the little butterflies in your stomach. And then you get it and it makes you super happy, albeit very temporary. And then, you know, you take the substance, whether it's drugs or food, and you get this temporary happy, this temporary high, if you will, and you feel good for a couple minutes. And then you look down at the wrappers or the empty bottle and you think, dang, like, that's it. It's over that fast. But for some reason, you regroup and just keep doing that same cycle over and over. So in that way, it's very similar. Also, you know, one of the things about food addiction, you know, compared to substance abuse, is food is everywhere and it's very much accepted. So for example, it's not that easy to get fentanyl, or it shouldn't be. And people obviously have, you know, a stereotype for people that abuse fentanyl or use fentanyl, where, you know, food, every time you turn on the TV, we're getting bombarded with marketing and, you know, that oozy cheese and those greasy burgers. And it's kind of just an accepted way of life. And if you're eating, you know, 2-3 double cheeseburgers at a time, no one ever really said anything to me. So in that way, I think it's harder, because it's very easy for me not to do fentanyl, alcohol, or opioids now, because they're just not a part of my environment. But food is different, because we have to eat, and that marketing and that food is everywhere we go, whether it's at work. You know, we try at home at our house to have the cleanest environment we can have, but I mean, you can't be a shut-in either. So, you know, we go to work and parties and things like that, and it's there all the time. So it's not something you can actually turn 100% off, if that makes sense.
It does. And that's something that people ask me a lot about is, well, how do you deal with it when it is everywhere? And I guess to a certain extent, what's worked for me is just to kind of put blinders on and establish really clear parameters for what is and is not off limits. And so I know that I just cannot go to the drive-thru, you know, and get a vegan burrito from Taco Bell, because I think that'd be like methadone for somebody who's in treatment, right? It's just a stepping stone. And so I really established those clear parameters. But nonetheless, it's very hard for someone in the beginning to not, I don't know, give in to temptation. Like, I find that it just does get a little bit easier over time as you have these rules for yourself. How long did it take for you to get comfortable with the idea of, I'm just not going to eat that stuff anymore, no matter how close I get to it? Even if I'm close enough to smell it, I'm just not going to eat it.
Yeah, so the food for me was pretty instant, which I'm very glad about that. I think, you know, I talked to somebody one time. I was interviewing someone for our membership, and he was a heart attack patient, and he died at work. He had a heart attack. He died. They shocked him 11 times, brought him back, and he had a 5% chance to live. So he found he was just Googling, you know, heart conditions and stuff, and Dr. Esselstyn's name came up. He emailed him, and believe it or not, within a day, Dr. Esselstyn was on the phone with this guy, which is super cool. But, you know, he switched to Plant Perfect that day. And I said, man, that had to be hard. He goes, not at all. He goes, when you're going to die, it's not hard at all. So sometimes I wonder, they say it takes 30 days to make a habit. But if you find out you're deathly allergic to peanuts, how long does it take to make a habit of not eating peanuts anymore? So sometimes I wonder if it really takes as long as we think it does. So it can be just a decision. So for me, I went all in. I'll put it this way. I went all in with what I knew. So I knew what was on forks over knives, basically. Did I have everything perfect? No. I didn't realize they hid oil in everything. So I was still eating some added oils. Things like that. And eventually, you know, you turn the dials. But no, you know, I think what happened to me, fortunately, is I spent less time on abstaining from foods that were no good for me and more time adding foods that were good. And that same thing, you know, transposed into my lifestyle. I had so many cool things that were happening and so many good things I was seeking out that, you know, by accident, it crowded out all the bad things. So, for example, you know, if you eat a big old, you know, pile of beans and greens for dinner, well, there's not much room left for the crappy food that you usually crave. And just like my life, I was having so much fun hiking and, you know, going on new adventures with Heather and stuff, that the sitting on the couch, vegging out, watching movies, I didn't have time for it anymore. So I think when we look at addiction, we can get, I mean, there has to be some kind of abstinence, right? We have to have abstinence, especially in the beginning. But I think the focus needs to be on, you know, designing a new life that we need not escape with food and substances. And I think if we put our energy into that, instead of just trying to have willpower until we don't, it's a lot easier, because the lifestyle I have now is only afforded to me by the choices I make, what I put in my body, food and drugs, alcohol. And I know that I cannot sustain this amazing, like, we just got back from a 12-mile run this morning together. It was beautiful. It was a little chilly here. But I can't do that, especially with the disease I have, if I'm going to go eat crappy food later. So I don't have to kind of worry so much about abstinence. I just have to worry about keeping this really cool lifestyle going, if that makes sense.
It does. So focus on all the things that you can eat versus the things that you can't. And I think that that's just a healthier, pardon the pun, way of looking at things. Because I think that, you know, even as a little kid, when you're told that you can't eat something or not to do something, what does it make you want to do? Eat it or do it even more, right? So focus on the things that you can imbibe in, and you'll be much happier that way. I think that's a really good way of looking at abstinence altogether, like all the great things that come flooding into your life as a result of it, not all the things that you're leaving behind. That's key. Nonetheless, I also think that that brings into the equation, you know, cheat days for people. And I personally am of the belief that a cheat day is the disaster, the doom, the downfall of anybody who's been on a healthier path. Because it's like dipping your toes back in those ugly waters and something's going to grab a hold of that toe and pull you right back under. It's so easy to do because you get that taste for it again and you're going to want to do it again and again and again and again and again. I'm sure people ask you all the time about cheat days and whether you have them. Do you?
Well, I don't. And yes, they do. Especially students. I get done with the high school talk. There's two questions they always want to know. Do I do cheat days? And what do I miss the most? You know, what food do I miss the most? But, you know, it's funny, Chuck. We look at these cheat days and we look at especially motivation. You know, these are things that we kind of only associate with our health and with food, but they don't work in any other part of our life. I mean, I can tell you, I won't ask her this, but I don't think it would work real well if me and Heather had cheat days. And I don't think my taxes would work real well if I had cheat days. But for some reason, we think it's going to work with food. And the reality is, on a cheat day, all you're doing is reintroducing, like you said, those hyper-palatable foods that you so crave, and it just makes the agony worse. Like your palate, you know this, your palate adjusts, and you know that Honeycrisp apple tastes sweeter than any donut I've ever had once your palate is adjusted. You know, the other thing is motivation goes right along in that basket to me about cheat days. Like, we think that we need to be motivated to be healthy. And the truth is, it doesn't work anywhere else in our life. Again, you go back to the mortgage payment. Like, if I called my bank and said, you know what, I was going to pay that payment, but I'm just not feeling motivated, so I'm not going to do it. You know, whether it's relationships or finances or anything else, motivation has nothing to do with our responsibility. And to me, you know, once you know how to eat more healthfully, it's your responsibility to do it, not just for yourself, right? For the people around you. And frankly, whether you're motivated or not, the job has to get done. And I don't know why we put these rules only in food, you know, only cheat days in food, motivation and health, and they don't work anywhere else. It's just kind of a weird thing.
It is weird, and it's celebrated, and I look at people's Instagrams, like The Rock. I love wrestling, and so to see his cheat days on Instagram, they're just like mind-blowing to me, the amount of food that the man is taking in, unhealthy food. And the problem there is that The Rock is the exception, okay? I think, by and large, he's a healthy guy, clearly not eating a plant-based diet, but that's a topic for another day. But the typical person, somebody like you or I, is going to see that and think, oh, well, The Rock eats this or that. The Rock is healthy. Therefore, I can eat this or that in that quantity, in that volume, and that's going to be healthy for me too. And that's really pulling the wool over our eyes. And nobody is thinking about it in the terms that you and I are discussing here today, that it is such a slippery slope. To put it, you know, concisely, you're not going to go on a diet, you know, or you're not going to give up smoking for 7 days and reward yourself with a cigarette, or give up drinking for a week, say that I'm no longer an alcoholic, and then toast yourself to your newfound sobriety with a beer. It doesn't make sense. Yet we do this time and again with food, Tim.
Right. And you know, there's two things happening there too with The Rock. He's only showing you that piece of, and this happens with social media in general, you just see that little clip of him overeating all this stuff. You don't see all the other days that he's right on point with his calories, and I'm sure he's got his macros and he's got a nutritionist. So you don't get to see that. You see that one time, and then you think that's like normal. The other thing, I would hope you would agree with this, that especially as food addicts, and I think people in general deal with food addiction on some level or another, that, you know, that cheat day, you know, there's a very few select people that actually can have a cheat day and go right back to it the next day. Most of the time, a cheat day turns into, well, you know, it's Saturday, I want to start Monday because I'm back to work. And then, well, it's 3 days from the first of the month. And then, you know, Well, it's December. We got parties, and there's always going to be an excuse to turn that cheap day into a cheap week, into a cheap month, and then finally we'll wait till New Year's, and the whole thing just falls apart. So it just doesn't work. It's not sustainable at all.
I agree, and you illustrate that perfectly, and we're going to talk about something other than food here. I just want to read this one paragraph from your book. It's on page 100. It begins. It says, at about 1 a.m., I woke up because I had to pee. I had a pounding headache, and I felt sick to my stomach. I stumbled out of the bathroom, and just as I lifted the lid to the toilet, I puked. I had made it in the nick of time. I took my jeans off and climbed back into bed. And when I woke up the next morning, I felt like I had been hit by a train. I felt worse than I had ever felt, missing 5 nights of sleep. I had a horrific hangover. My head was pounding as I tossed a handful of pills in my stomach like I did every morning. My mouth was dry and disgusting. Although I slept a few hours that night, I felt worse than ever. Feeling awful in the morning was quite normal from the opioids, but this morning was unlike any other morning. I felt like absolute crap. This is where you are supposed to say, lesson learned, and move on with life, but unfortunately, that 16 ounces of vodka would be the smallest amount of alcohol I would consume before bed over the following years. So think about that. Think about what I just read from your book, Tim, talking about alcohol there. And then think about how you feel after you have those cheat days. You probably feel like crap, but at the same time, you can't wait to do it again next week or the next cheat day or tomorrow or later on today. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's weird. It's a weird pull too. And I feel that there's a very big similarity between, you know, that what I was talking about is actually the first time I had ever drank. And so, you know, when you compare that to food, 100%, like, you feel like crap, but for some reason you want to do it again. And I think, you know, people looking in say, well, you like to drink. I did not like to drink at all. I did not like to overeat either. But, you know, I don't know what it is inside of my head that just kept me going back to the same thing that was poisoning me. And you would justify this whole scenario, and somehow you just do it all again the next day. It's a very strange place to be, and you're clouded by it. You can't see what's going on when you're inside of it. You know, if people would have asked me then if I had a problem, I probably would have said no. Probably at the end, I knew that my time was short. But, you know, I just never saw it happening while I was in it until I was so deep. I think at one point in the book, I said I needed a ladder to get to the bottom of my hole. You know, I was so far gone that I didn't think there was a way back.
Rock bottom can be a scary place, and people can either choose to really just lay down and die, wave the white flag for life at that point, or get that ladder, climb to the bottom, and then put in the work to climb out of the hole to begin with altogether. Why did you choose life?
So, oddly enough, I don't know if I was choosing life. I think I was choosing delayed death. Yeah, it's so wild to like look back on this, but so Heather, we had just buried my father, and things became really rare, very real for me at that point. I think if I was to pick out a rock bottom, I had many rock bottoms, but probably the final bottom was sitting by my dad's grave site as he was getting lowered into the grave. And, you know, I had a few times where I had quit the pills because I was withdrawing so much. Like, I would take, you know, a whole month's prescription in like, you know, 3-4 days. So I had these ups and downs. So I was used to withdrawals, and I had been trying to get cleaned up. And then, you know, when my dad died, you know, I went full on. Like, I went on a huge binge. And I was a mess at the funeral. That's how the book opens up, at the side of his grave. So I would say that was the rock bottom. But the point is, after, you know, we buried my dad, Heather's mom, you know, had leukemia that turned into lymphoma and ultimately a brain tumor, would end her life early. So we buried her. And there was a moment where, you know, Heather was getting me dressed and where she was putting my socks and shoes on. And I thought, oh, crap. Like, two funerals pretty much in a row, she's got to do another one. And I didn't want her to do another funeral this soon. My idea was, let's get some space in between these. Just give her a break. Let things get back to normal. Let the kids get back into practice and start the sports again. Kind of get back into a routine. I mean, we've been running to cancer wards and blood transfusions and, you know, picking out caskets and putting, you know, obituaries in the paper, things that I never knew we would ever have to do. And I just, all I could think of is, like, I got to space my death out so she gets a break between funerals. She can do this next year. So the reality was, when I started going on this road to try to get better, it wasn't really to get better. It was just to not die as soon, if that makes sense. It was probably a dumb idea. But, you know, I was able to build off success. And that's why I'm still alive today. I'm convinced that I would have been dead over a decade ago if I wouldn't have changed something.
No, man, that makes perfect sense to me. And it sounds a lot like the way that I was thinking when I had weight loss surgery. Was it wasn't that this was the solution. This is going to help me to get to 30, but at least by the time that I die at 40, I will be able to have said that I have tried everything. You know, I had still pretty much resigned myself to die and had no idea going into it that my life was going to change in such a profound way. Had no idea that I would ever stumble upon this plant-based thing, which would completely revolutionize my health, just as you have. There's so many similarities there, man. I've never honestly heard anybody explain it quite like that. And I'm wondering if there are other people out there like you and I who kind of feel the same way, that they weren't originally intending for this to be a forever thing. They were just trying to delay what at that point they still thought was the inevitable.
Yeah. And I feel like I was dealt a hand of cards, you know, especially with the disease that I had. And I had played them to my best of the ability that I had. And that was how it's going to be. But let me ask you a question. Like, what gave you the idea that there was no other way out? I mean, I guess because I want to know this, because how can I know there's other people that were sitting right where me and you were, Chuck? And I think there's a lot of people that just, they have lost hope because they feel like they've tried everything. So what gave you that idea that there was nothing left to try?
In hindsight, it's easy to think, you know, it's just a figment of my imagination. But I can tell you that it was the emotional trauma I'd been through, you know, the fact that I'd been with this girl and she refused to even acknowledge that we were a couple publicly. Like, we had to stay closeted that we were in a relationship because she was ashamed to be with somebody who was my size. So, like, my feeling of self-worth was just garbage. Still, nobody had ever told me what it meant to eat healthy. So I was kind of flying blind. And then you think back to all of the failed attempts that I had to lose weight. I shouldn't say they were failed. I mean, a lot of them were successful, but keeping it off always failed. And so it comes right back. And so you just get defeated time and time and time and time and time again. So of course, why would you think anything else is going to be any different? So you resign yourself to defeat. You resign yourself to death. And when you've been beaten down that many times, we're talking dozens and dozens and dozens of times. And so much more on top of that, seeing your own family members die from this damn obesity disease and heart disease and cancer and all of that stuff. Like, why would you think your life would be any different? What possible reason would there be for your life to be any different? And so that is that prison that you're talking about that we build for ourselves. And so I absolutely put myself in the emotional slammer and resigned myself to die because I just didn't know any differently, Tim.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that. I feel that 100%. And I think that along, like, the story that I told myself, and then along with the doctors, right? Like, because the doctors were all about, you know, not even maintaining, just like slowing the process down. There was no talk about getting better. It was just treating these symptoms that would come up from other, you know, I take so many pain pills and then I was constipated. I couldn't sleep. So they do sleeping pills. And then, you know, that would mess up my stomach. So then it's just one thing after, and you just get into this thing, like, you know, there's, it's just exist and there's nothing left. And it's a sad place. And I think, you know, if one thing can happen from my book is to let people know, man, there's always hope out there. And even when you have yourself convinced that there's not, you know, one of the things you said about this constant failure, a lot of my stumbling, I don't believe in coincidence, but you know, at the time it looked like these accidents like all aligning, but I was never a journaling kind of person. You know, I was a big Harley dude, you know, I had a whole closet full of Carhartts. You know, we didn't journal, like that's just the thing. But for some reason, I just asked Heather to get me a spiral notebook, you know, left over from the kids. I tore some pages out and I started writing stuff down. And this is so cool because I had no clue at the time what was happening. And I wouldn't know until years later. But I wrote down what my goals were for the day. And my goal, if you've ever heard my story, was to get out of a chair twice. But that wasn't the important thing that was happening. At the end of the day, I just felt like I should put something in that journal, like a check mark or something. And at the bottom of the page, I said, I did good. I did good today. And, you know, looking back, like that was life-changing for me. That was actually the first, you know, that was the first time I ever had any kind of self-love or, you know, self-congratulations. And what that did is it put it in writing that I had a mini win. And I couldn't wake up the next day and tell myself how stupid I was, what a loser I was. I can never do this. I fail at everything because it was right there in black and white. And that stupid little line, I did good, was the beginning of starting to snowball, you know, some victories. And it was such a small victory. But I think that's important for people. We are always so good at finding the faults, finding what's wrong with us. But man, document your victories, celebrate them, you know, pat yourself on, be your biggest fan for these victories, no matter how small they are, because they build. Just like the bad stuff builds, so does the good stuff.
Bro, like I got choked up when you said that. I did good today. I can see how just reading that back, that was probably the first time you ever felt happy about something in a very long time. I did good today. You rewarded yourself. You're not a failure. You're not a mess up. You're somebody who can still do good. That gives you value. To me, what that does is it gives you permission and initiates that drive to stick around because you did good. You're worth right. it. You have value to this earth. You have value to your family. You did good. You are capable of doing good. I love that, Tim Kaufman. I freaking love that.
Yeah. The wild thing about that, Chuck, is that did not become powerful for multiple years later. Okay. And it was just when I looked through that journal, I'm like, this was it. Like, it was almost like an investigator going back like, oh, you see what happened there? That was different.
I got you. But when was the last time anybody told you that you had done good or you told yourself that you had done good? Because I'm sure you felt like a total screw up until that point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how could you not, right? Standing in the mirror looking, you know, at a beast of a person, you know, and the food and the obesity was one thing, but the substance, you know, I was manipulating everyone. And to be, I think we've had this discussion before, you know, a lot of the, you know, really pro tips for manipulating that I learned with substance, it also worked with food. You know, I could buy that extra burger and, you know, down it before I got home. And I could always, I think we talked about this too, I could pretend I was ordering for a family, even though it was just me. Just as long as you get, you know, four drinks, it doesn't matter what you order because it's for a family then. So that stuff's hard. That stuff's hard to deal with when you look in the mirror knowing that you spent your day lying and manipulating people to get what you want. It's hard to look in the mirror and actually love yourself. So that was the toughest thing for me, is learning, you know, how to accept and love myself. But if you can't figure out how to do that, I think it's impossible to change. You know, you got to want the best for yourself.
Absolutely. And let's wrap up with this for the plant curious or the plant minded who are listening, which is about 99.999% of the audience, man. A lot of people are probably wondering, well, how did this plant-based diet factor into your evolution? Because that's what I'm going to call it. Because I think that you're a beautiful soul, always have been, always will be, that is constantly evolving. So how did the plants factor into that?
It's a, probably a very complicated answer, but I'll make it as simple as possible. Well, you know, for me, I have this disease, and the disease was causing awful inflammation and chronic pain. You know, I wasn't just taking pain pills for fun. That's not how it started. I have a legit disease, and I had so much inflammation, so much arthritis. By the time I was 25, my body looked like it was 70 years old.
Autoimmune disease?
No, it's called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So the glue that holds my body together is super stretchy. So I dislocate all the time. I was constantly twisting my ankles. It got so bad that I would sneeze and my shoulder would just dislocate. I still have this disease. It's a genetic screw up. You know, the glue that holds my body together isn't right. You know, there's something wrong with it. And so my whole life, I was in chronic pain. My jaw would dislocate every time I ate. Things were always popping and crunching, and I was always in the ER. I was always in cast of braces and canes and crutches. You know, I'd get crutches for my knees, and I push weight down, and then they pop my shoulders out. Like, it was just, it was like playing whack-a-mole, you know, trying to fix stuff. So that said, that's when the medication started, like the pain management stuff started, and, you know, and soothing it with food, because food was the thing that, you know, made me feel good. And, you know, so through all that, you had this, you know, spiral downhill, because now I'm moving less because they told me don't do anything, go home and sit. They told me to quit my job and get a job that was sedentary. And so I had a factory job. I actually got into to teaching, which turned out to be a great thing. So I had all these things set. And again, this is the cards that I had, and I was playing them. I wasn't supposed to move. I had chronic pain, and there I sat. Well, when I started eating a plant-exclusive diet, you know, 11 years ago, I went on a juice fast for 30 days only because I saw Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead, and I just wanted what Joe had. I mean, we raised all our own meat. I grew up on a dairy farm. We hunted, we fished. My life was meat, processed meat, smoking meat, curing meat. And now, you know, January 1st, I'm jamming kale into a machine with a lip full of tobacco. But finding that food actually was medicine, accidentally, all of a sudden, the inflammation is just leaving my body. And, you know, the pain with the inflammation is leaving. Do I still have EDS? Yes. Do I still have pain? 100%. I almost got my leg amputated last year. But the food keeps the inflammation at bay. And it's the complete opposite of how I used to eat. So I used to eat, you know, processed fast food, oils, sugars, animal products. All this stuff was inflaming my joints, making a situation that was already bad a million times worse. So once I switched to, you know, dark leafy greens and beans and starches, that stuff went away. So not only did the inflammation go away, obviously I started shedding weight, which was a lot easier on my joints. But the most important thing it did is it gave me energy. And man, I was bored. You know, so I used to do as little as I possibly could, go to work and come home and crash. And now I'm getting bored on the couch. I'm getting antsy. And I started walking. You know, they told me not to walk, but I'm like, man, I feel good. And I kept walking. And, you know, I started with a mile and then 2 miles. And before I knew it, you know, braces, canes, and crutches, I'm walking 5 and 6 miles through the woods. The doctor made me some new braces, and I started, you know, going hiking in the mountains. And before I knew it, I was running 5Ks and 10Ks and half marathons and full marathons and ultras and Ironmans. And it's like, it's the food gave me this life. If I would have done it without plants, let's say I would have just calorie reduced, I would still have all the inflammation. I would still have all the pain. But because of the way I eat, it allows me. And that's what I was referring to before. You know, I love my lifestyle. I love how active I am. I'm, you know, 50 years old. I was supposed to be in a wheelchair 25 years ago. And there's few people that can keep up with me. And I can't sustain that lifestyle without eating plant exclusive, because I eat very selfishly. I am selfish about what's on my plate. The things that are on my plate benefit me, you know, with the colors and all the micronutrients and the antioxidants and all the beautiful vitamins and nutrients. And I'm selfish about that. I want as much as I can out of my food to help my body as medicine. So that's a very long answer. And it's a very dynamic answer because, you know, food affects so many parts of our lives. It's not just to look good in a bathing suit. I mean, our body does not want to be sick. It doesn't. It wants to thrive, but we got to give it the tools to thrive. And that's why we eat these colorful foods, foods that aren't dead. They're full of life. And it's better, you know, for our health, obviously, but it's better for the environment, the economy, and the animals, obviously. So it's a win for everyone. And that's, I'm sorry, I'm ranting now, but, you know, it's that important to me.
And I got you. And that's what I love about your story, is because it's you, but it's the bigger picture at the same time. And I'm so happy for you and your transformation, the man that you have become, and the way that you're inspiring thousands of people around the world through your communities, and of course with the book Escape as well. Just such a powerful, profound read. Tim, thank you so much for being here today, my friend.
Chuck, thanks for having me, and keep crushing it, man.
I did good. When was the last time you told yourself that? When was the last time you said, I did good? I watched the interview back with my cousin. He was sitting with me at the table, and all my cousin could say was, wow. I mean, imagine that, a grown man after decades finally acknowledging that he wasn't a failure, finally acknowledging that he can succeed. And it's okay to say it. It's okay to say, I did good. And tell yourself that as you head toward a healthier path. Not every day is going to be peachy, of course not. The road will be rocky at times. There will be challenges, that's life. And there will be obstacles, and you will feel alone. And you may even beat yourself up after having a slip, but that does not serve you well. That self-defeat, that attitude only leads you back to exactly where it is that you don't want to go. So tell yourself this, say it, I did good. Write it down, read it back, I did good. Build yourself up and you will be fine. You will absolutely be fine. And I love that. Tim Kaufman, what a conversation. Be sure to get your copy of his book, Escape. There is a link to it in the episode notes. Talk about motivation, man. I hope that has you all fired up, ready to take on the world no matter what challenges life decides to throw at you. You got this. You got this, and you can do good. No doubt about it. And hey, while we have a minute, I want to say thank you to everyone who came out to see me in Seattle at the Planted Expo. Very cool weekend spent in the Pacific Northwest. Had never been there before and absolutely loved it. So great to catch up with Carly Bodrug and Robert Cheek again. And of course, the Doc and Chef, Karen Dugan and Jim Loomis. And then Steven and the army of workers behind the scenes doing so much to put on this incredible Planted Expo, making their U.S. debut. First time in the States. And what an event that it was. And also so great to see so many of you the following night, that Monday night at the Seattle Public Library with Dr. Neil Barnard. We were there for the Power Foods Diet event. He's continuing his speaking tour, and it was cool to be able to team up with him while I was in town in Seattle. Had so much fun there and meeting and greeting, and just Seattle is, it really is a fun town. My wife Julie told me that it was a lot of fun, and true to her word, it sure was. And a good friend of mine also, he gave me my big break in radio. guy by the name of John Ballard. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, he was on DC 101. He was the afternoon voice of DC 101 for years before coming over and taking on mornings at WBIG, Big 100.3, where he and I linked up. He also is from Seattle. Said that place is just amazing, will forever be home for him. And sure enough, I can see why. And speaking of back home in Washington, D.C., for me anyway, our nation's capital, it's almost D.C. Veg Restaurant Week, and this year is bigger and more delicious than ever. It's running May 6th through the 12th, but there's a kickoff VIP celebration with the co-chairs of the festivities, Washington Wizards coach Joseph Blair, who was just on the exam room with us, and TV personality Bershan Shaw. And that's going down at Rooted 3 in Bethesda on May 4th, so a couple of days before the official start of DC Veg Week. But I have dropped ticket info for this big VIP event for you in the episode notes if you're interested in going. I've heard amazing things about Rooted 3, by the way, so if you do go, let me know how it is. Got a lot of people here at the Physicians Committee who love it there, so let me know if it's the bomb for you as well. So really cool to see our friend JB, the vegan coach, coming up in the vegan world as well and hosting this party. That's pretty cool. And shout out to some of the other restaurants who are going to be participating in DC Veg Restaurant Week. We've got DC Vegan, our friends there, of course, leading the charge. Almeida is going to be there. El Tamarindo, Equinox on 19th, Gingerbeat, they're all participating, and a whole host of others. So that's coming up very, very, very soon. So more details on that to come. And then looking ahead, May 16th and 17th, I'm going to be speaking at the Lifestyle Medicine Pathway to Health and Happiness Symposium in Rochester, Minnesota. That is going to be in conjunction with the Lotus Health Foundation, very cool organization. And Brenda Davis is going to be there. Dr. Brian Carlson from the Mayo Clinic is going to be there. So many others. There's a full list of speakers and ticket information available for you right now at lotushealthfoundation.org, or you can click the link in the episode notes. And for today, that is going to wrap things up. I want to say thank you one more time to Tim Kaufman for being here and sharing his incredible insight and wisdom with us. He did good. He absolutely did good today. And for everyone at the Physicians Committee, I am the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll. Thank you so very much for listening. And remember, as always, keep it plant-based.